Bow hunters are some of the hardest working hunters there are. Most of us work hard all year long just to get a couple weekends or burn our vacation time to sit in a tree. And just like the American blue collar worker, we're trying to balance work, family, faith, and a little time for ourselves in the great outdoors. Now let me introduce you to Trollco Clothing, a brand built by blue collar workers for blue collar workers. Workwear, comfortable tees, hoodies and hats for both men and women, Trollco represents the hardworking American. So whether you're operating heavy equipment, wrenching on engines, or in a factory living that shift life, Trollco has your back, literally. Head to trollco.com/hunting. That's trollco.com/hunting and enter the discount code Empire25 for 25% off of your first order. Trollco, for the hardworking American. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, brought to you by Full Sneak Gear. Check out their entire lineup at fullsneakgear.com. Also, be sure to check out our entire stable of podcasts at sportsmansempire.com. This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries. Outrageously dependable.
Welcome to Maximize Your Hunt, the podcast dedicated to those who want the most out of their hunting property. This podcast explores land management, habitat improvement, and hunting strategies that will help you maximize your time in the field. Follow along as industry professionals that live and breathe whitetail deer share their secrets to success. And now, the founder of Whitetail Landscapes, your host, John Teeter.
Hi, it's John Teeter, Whitetail Landscapes. Welcome back, everybody. Let's see what I've been up to. Oh, today was a crazy day for me. I took a nice stroll with my kids, and we planted about 25 trees, honey locusts and crab apple trees today. And we got caught in a rainstorm. It was just kind of a mess. But you know what? You know, this is the time to get things done. I have a day or two window. I'm on the road next week. I think I have a client on Saturday as well. So I've got to get my own personal, you know, activities kind of out of the way. I think I got another 20 or 30 trees to plant. And I think I'm done, at least on my personal property. Then the start of the new property where I think tomorrow I'm going to go mark all the timber for timber stand improvement work. And I got two big box blinds in the other day. I'm setting those up. So I'm just getting everything ready for my new piece so I can focus on all my client work the rest of the summer. I've got some client cutting coming up that I've got to really, you know, pay a lot of attention to and focus on. So my personal projects will go by the wayside probably out until August. And then I just got a slew of clients this year. So I'm quite busy. I got Todd Shippey back, and it's been, geez, Todd, how long has it been for you and I? It's been hunting season.
Quite a while.
Yeah. We caught up maybe, I don't know, a couple weeks ago and just shot it and just I got to see how your season went, and you've been traveling a little bit. So you want to talk about anything to do with maybe hunting, any great kills you've had, anything along those lines?
I had wrapped up a great hunting season. All my clients did really well. Everybody's happy. Shot some nice deer, some nice big bucks. I had a good season with my brother-in-law and stuff. So we had fun and just been working. Usually through the winter, I don't work as much. But this year here in Wisconsin, we've had no snow and deep freeze. So I was able to access a bunch of marshes. So we've been really busy getting into areas that we normally can't get into and being able to see things that we can't normally see. So we took advantage of that and been really quite busy.
Todd, today when I was setting up these trees, basically my system is my kids lay out all the, you know, the tree tubes and the mats and the stakes and everything we put down. And we pin down these, I don't know if you've ever used them. They're called like cocoa mats or cocoa guards. They're in a circular shape. Have you used those before?
Yeah, they work pretty good.
Yeah, I think they work pretty good too. And we use top pins. Next week, what I'm working on, I've got a client trip, but before I leave on a client trip, I got to cut a few thousand willows. And I'm doing, basically what I'm doing is I'm prepping, because in a few years, I think I'm going to be selling willows, just because I've got such a good need for those. And I have them in so many plans, but I just have so much physical labor that I've been doing lately. I mean, staying in good shape. So, you know, I think you've probably been feeling the same way. All right, let's get into some of the questions. We got some questions in from some of the listeners. I'm going to read them off. You're going to just dialogue a little bit. We can chat about a few things here and there and just, you know, just figure out what makes sense for these guys. So again, these are questions from some time ago. Appreciate everybody submitting those. So thank you for doing that. I'm going to read through. I'm not going to mention your name or locations or anything like that. We're just going to keep everything anonymous, but we'll just get into the specifics. All right, here's the first question. Had a bad storm and a possible tornado came through. I had a bunch of blowdowns throughout my woods and at the beginning of the season. My question is, do you go in and clean out deer trails and disturb the woods, or do you leave it alone and deer will navigate through it? So basically, he had a bunch of blowdowns throughout my woods at the beginning, I'm assuming, of hunting season. Let's just talk about in general when this happens. What is your typical tact? How do you approach this, Todd?
Well, it depends. So every situation is different, but in those situations, when I've experienced it on my own land or on client property, if the blowdowns are blocking the deer from coming past the stands or inhibiting them from getting into bedding or through any of your natural pinch points, then you want to clean them up and make access, you know, for the deer to use them. But if it's in an area that maybe was in need of logging or was more wide open and it knocks some stuff down, sometimes I'll take a sit back and wait and see what happens approach, because I always like to wait to see, if possible, wait to see how the deer and the wildlife use the blowdowns, use what nature gave it, and then enhance that a little bit. So if, I guess it's hard to explain. I mean, if clearly nothing is going to be able to go through it, maybe they're going to bed on the side of it. Maybe if it's blown down in an east and west direction, you know they're going to lay on the south side of that all winter long. Maybe you're going in later and just enhance some of those bedding areas, and it worked out good for you. Sometimes Mother Nature gives you a gift that you couldn't have done better yourself. And then other times, if you can wait, enhance, see how they use it, enhance that. But if it's blocking the natural deer flow towards your stands or towards where you want them to go, then obviously you would get in there right away and clean it up.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And I've had a lot of experiences on properties where there are blowdowns. And the nice part is sometimes there's still root attachment. So the tree, depending if you need the cover, you want the tree to live, they do live. It's just a matter of accessibility. And again, if it's in the right location, it could be ideal. If it's in the wrong location, then you've got a mess to clean up. So you got to work through that. All right, Todd, let's bounce over to the next question. This is a pretty good one. Recently, you asked for podcast topic ideas, and I thought of a situation on my property that I need to deal with. I have a large amount of invasives, mostly autumn olive and honeysuckle, but some multiflora rose and buckthorn too. My question or topic idea is twofold. What would be the best way to remove invasive species on large scale? Once they are removed, how should I think about replacing them on the landscape? What native shrubs or trees should I plant in their place? What is the best way to protect them from overbrowsing? Or is it better to let the natural seed bank take over, knowing that if I need to aggressively follow up with spot treatments due to invasives that are still in the seed bank? That's a pretty good question.
Yeah, a pretty standard answer. I'm not sure what he means by large scale. Does he mean 40 acres of it, or does he mean 5 acres of it? I think the approach I would take instantly is do about an acre and a half, clear it all out and see what's in the soil bank, see what comes back, see if there is a possibility of the good stuff coming back. More than likely, it's not. The invasives are overtaking it because they grow faster, they grow earlier, and they stay green later. But if you would get so lucky, see what's in the native. Natives are always easiest, and spot treat. But more than likely, the invasives are going to come back. So then you'll have to take a couple years of wiping that out and then replaced with shrubs, and any trees would be trees that bear, you know, a diversity of different kinds of acorns. And I always like to throw some chestnut in and then shrubs, think shrubs more than trees. You know, trees are great for tree stands and the ones that bear fruit, whether it be nut or soft mast or hard mast, but mainly think shrubs. Shrubs are better for deer habitat. And some of the invasives at times, I mean, buckthorn, you don't want it to overtake your woods and inhibit reforestation of your natives, but you can hinge those. They stay green way into November when everything else has lost their leaves. So sometimes if you have a woods that's a little bit overgrown and maybe you have permission to hunt it, but it's not your property, so you can't have it logged, you can lay those down. You can tie them down. You don't even have to cut them. You know, so sometimes those are okay. And autumn olive, they fix a lot of nitrogen. I know in the UK, when they plant an oak tree, they plant autumn olive next to them because they fix so much nitrogen. You get a significant more growth out of that oak tree. Autumn olive, it is invasive. It gets very invasive, especially by tilled soil. If it's standard soil or soil that's not tilled, it's not as bad. And it can be a decent habitat tree, but it can get out of control where it's just a thick, thorny patch of nothing wants to go in there or come out of it.
All right. My only thought on that is nothing you said I disagree with. I've fogged areas. I've spot treated areas. You know, it's what you want to do and how intrusive or large scale you want to get. I like to start like with areas, like for me personally, and this is the mental side of things. If you have 5 or 10 acres that is just chock full of non-native plants, pick one or two species that you want to deal with in a 1 to 2 acre area and see how long it takes you to approach those. Usually, instead of getting the areas that are overly thick, I start with areas that are they're a little more diverse. They may have a diversity of plants, not all non-native plants. And it just gives you that mental mindset where you can kind of leap through it at a faster rate. That's the simple way to do it. That just shows some progression. The other thought I had was, to Todd's point earlier, is some of these plants like autumn olive, for example, we don't have a large volume of it, particularly in my area in Central New York, but I typically cut those off and I keep cutting them and cutting them and cutting them, and then let the deer tire out the plant. And there's the same thing sometimes happens with multiflora rose. They keep it at bay. The buckthorn in my area, like on my new property that I'm working on, I'm using it for all sorts of stuff. I'm cutting it. I'm piling. I'm going to burn it in my kiln. I'm hacking and squirting portions of it because I want the structures. I want grapes to grow over it. I mean, I think sometimes using it for structure or resources. I mean, I've cut it and I've used it along banks to eliminate erosion. I mean, there's so many things that I've done recently with just using the material and setting it just waste. I don't like a lot of dead standing trees because then it's a maintenance thing. But I mean, a stem of a buckthorn plant, you know, a small, you know, it's a small street tree, it's small structure. It can be, you know, awesome infrastructure for holding deer. So it's, you know, it's how you're going to manage that in the landscape. I guess, Todd, let's talk a little bit about replacements. And one thing I was going to mention was some of these nitrogen fixing plants, one that I've put in place or next to trees, like you mentioned the oak trees in the UK, or maybe in our areas, crabapple or apple trees. Again, most of them are not native as well. I use a plant called buffalo berry, and it's a small shrub. You got to protect it. It kind of does well in drier areas, but it's a nitrogen fixing plant that produces a berry. It's native to our area, particularly in the Northeast. So that's another option. And today what I was planting was a crabapple and a honey locust, a crabapple and a honey locust. And that's the orientation I do those. And they're all tree tubed, et cetera, in that manner. And with my client designs, that's the same thing I recommend. So just a thought there to add. All right, let me ask you.
Backing up on the guy with the forest and invasives, the reason I say start with a small area is because you don't want to wipe out like 5 or 10 or 20 or even 40 acres and find out it's more than you can handle. And then all the invasives come back even worse and you have none of the natives. So start small, see what works, what doesn't work. And then you can take bigger chunks when you figure out what's the best route to take.
Todd, I got a question for you. So, and I have not done this, so I don't have any experience, but we had somebody on the podcast who had a drone sprayer, an aerial sprayer, and they were going through and they were hitting, you know, during the summer months, you know, based on the appropriate conditions, hitting some of these with a drone. Have you seen anybody doing any of that out your way? We have not in my area.
Just on ag fields, and I've been trying to get a drone sprayer in on a few areas where I want to stop. I can't get out to some canary grass way out in the middle of some swamps. I'd like to have it sprayed. I've been trying to get a drone operator in this area. I've called like a half dozen of them, and I can't get anybody that will. They say they want to do like 100-acre minimums or 40-acre minimums. I'll say, I'll even pay you whatever the minimum is, but I want to try it to see how it works. And I just, I can't get anybody to do it. But I think that's a really good way. If you could get guys in the spring to spray some canary out there, you'll regenerate your cattails better.
I think that's great.
And red osier dogwood, gray bark dogwood, the tag alder, all that stuff that gets smothered out by canary grass. I think it would be a really efficient way to do it.
Let's bounce over to same question. Should I replace them on the landscape? So you mentioned in your approach that, you know, you should see what comes back in the native seed bank, but with the presumption that the native seed bank is polluted, it's got non-native plants because they've just, you know, they've taken over an area. The seed bank is just chock full of them. In those cases, you know, what do you think somebody should do? Should somebody go in with a mulcher? Should somebody just spray or kill everything? I mean,
yeah, you got to spray. You got to do cereal. The only way you're going to get there is you got to do cereal herbicide applications until you exhaust them in the seed bank, and then go in and plant your natives. Once you exhaust the seeds in the soil bank, so that none of them are viable because the sunlight can't hit them, they're buried too deep, or they've already germinated and you killed them with a herbicide. Now you've got a blank slate that you can go in and put natives back in.
Okay. Any recommendations on what natives, like a couple examples of autumn olive and honeysuckle or buckthorn, what are plants that you like to use, assuming these are upland areas, so it's relatively dry, would you put in those particular as replacements?
I always say a tree has to give something back to the wildlife and to the thing. So I like hard mast, soft mast. Some will be that are good hinge cut trees, but I usually stick around depending on the area, because we have really bad oak wilt in the western part of our state. So, you know, to stick in reds, pins, reds, any of those, it just doesn't work. So whites are less susceptible to it. So usually, you know, a variety of whites, I throw in some pins. I really like pin oak because they hold their leaves. I'll throw in hickory, believe it or not, deer gobble up hickory nuts like crazy. I've seen it multiple times. And then some soft mast trees, get a higher area, block off an area for some apple and some crab apple, pear. That's usually it. If I get, you know, because the oak trees hinge cut so well, unless I need to get some stuff up right away for like tree stands and that, I'll stick in a hybrid poplar. And then once they get about, 15, well, when they get about an 8-inch trunk, I cut them off at about 10 feet, just completely off, and the tree will coppice up and grow like a little handstand. We've talked about that before. And then you can kind of nurture that, and you grow some tree stand trees while you're waiting for the other trees, or hinge them, whatever. Aspen is a nice one to throw in because it's a high value wildlife tree. It doesn't bear fruit, but they like to rub it. They like to eat the little shrubs it grow, you know, or the little root suckering that comes up. They'll do that. It's good habitat for grouse, deer, everything. So aspen, if you have a dry area, I like to get in. Wet area, go with big tooth aspen. They're hard to find on the market, big tooth aspen, but if you can, they're really good because they do the same thing but in wet areas.
Yeah, those are great. I'll just add a little bit to this. Is I would think about, in if you're just trying to create structure, and there was an aspect of food and structure in Todd's suggestion, is one of the plants to go to in my area is ninebark. We plant ninebark if you're looking for understory shrubs, as well as hazelnut. That's pretty popular in my area. Some of the viburnums, the dogwoods that Todd had talked about quickly. Some of the plum varieties are okay in the areas. Don't expect a big interest in deer. And then in my particular property, it's ninebark and spice bush. Those are generally what we use for replacement plants. I've got spice bush all through the property. If you have spice bush browsed on your property by white-tailed deer, you got a food issue across your landscape. So just you keep that in mind. Just on service a property.
Serviceberry is a good one. If you throw in serviceberry, they really blossom before anything, and it's a good tree. And then you mentioned the chestnuts. Those are nice because they not chestnut. What did you say? The other
hazelnuts.
Hazelnut. They're eating the catkins now that are hanging down the deer. Like there's no catkins for as high as a deer can reach. So they're good protein for them right now in those catkins. And then they'll give you a bunch of nuts up tall. I really like, I have a couple of hedges of those. I really like hazelnut.
Yeah, I like them. I agree with you. Add them to the hedges is kind of like the UK thing. That makes a lot of sense. All right. Anything, let's see. Is there anything else that we should hit on this one? I think we knocked that out pretty good. All right, let's go to question three. I've been listening to your podcast, and I want to know more about eradicating reed canary grass. Todd, this is like your favorite topic. How to use reed canary grass to your advantage? You always say fight invasives with other plants. I've been experimenting with planting 5 living stakes to get the RCG, that would be reed canary grass, and shade it out. Though there's not much information online I could find. So they're looking for replacement plants. They're looking at for eradication. Why don't you go through your process? We've talked about this before. I think it's a great topic.
Yeah. So in a perfect world, I like to burn it first. Because once you burn it, it's the first thing that's going to green up right away. So its strength, as we talked about in the past, its strength is its weakness. It's the first thing to green up in the spring. So even if you can't burn it, you'll see it green. Go out there and spray it. If you're not worried about killing other things, because it's normally the only thing that comes out of dormancy first, you can just simply spray it with Roundup. If it's a little bit later or you're in a warmer climate where other things are budding out, then I would use Cleth on it while it's short. And so my Mazifer will give you carryover, but you don't want to get that too much on dogwood or any other things. It'll act as a pre-emerge to stop it from coming back. But once you wipe it out, you just wait. It'll green up again. Spray it again, and pretty much the cattails and the other things that in the soil bank should come back. Generally speaking, where you have it, it's usually somewhere upstream, and there's probably a foot of seed in the soil bank. So cattails are the best thing to compete with it. And as far as using it to your advantage, I did see some guys on YouTube that talk about, you know, if you do a blowdown or you do a hinge cut, the stuff will come up through there and kind of stand up for a while. If I have some extra treetops, if I'm doing some work, I'll just use my grapple on my tractor and toss them out in areas and let the stuff come up through a cattails, a canary. Deer like to lay on the southern side of that. But that's how you take care of reed canary. As far as putting in trees that to shade it, good luck, because that reed canary is going to stay green way after those leaves fall and suck in the sunlight. So it's the last thing in the fall to stop doing what it's doing. So to shade it is a pretty difficult thing to do. It starts growing before the leaves are on, and it keeps growing after the leaves are off. And the trick is, in the area that you're working, is never, ever, ever let it go to seed again. So you kill it when it's young, you let it come back, you kill it again, and the trick is to never let it go to seed, so it's not introducing more seeds to the soil bank. As far as and sticking in those the sticks or any kind of vegetation to compete with it is really, in essence, a fool's errand, because it gets 5 to 6 feet tall, and then it lays down that 5 to 6 feet, so it walks, you know, it lays its seed 5 to 6 feet away, and it comes so thick that it lays, even if it's laying down, it wraps around the base of anything you try to plant and just smothers it out, more grows. So this is the time of year. I just did this with a client. He's got a really nice former cedar and dogwood swamp that's wiped out with reed canary, but all the stuff is there and trying to live. I said, if you go through the rake and some cleth and get it away from the bases and keep pulling it away and then kill some of it, you can get it reestablished and get all the other stuff established to compete with it. And I think all of you know, like if you do have a pocket, a lot of times you'll see remnants of red osier dogwood that was wiped out by it. You can pull it away. You'd be surprised how fast that grows. And then by simply taking one of the tall branches of a red osier dogwood and stick it down on the ground and just set a rock on top of it, that's a new plant right there. From that branch, roots will go down the ground, and then that will grow up, and you can really get it to walk just like canary grass walks in established bigger areas. And once it starts to grow new, though, if you have a high deer population, you're going to want to put some sort of fencing around it just to get it up out of there a little bit. Otherwise, the deer just keep it trimmed, and it's really difficult to outcompete the canary when that's happening.
Todd, I got a few questions for you, and this is funny. I was on a client property with it, same exact description that you had, cedar swamp in combination with reed canary. Cedars had established in pockets on the higher ground. The lower ground, the canary took over. Right, it was your dogwood was fine, trying to find space in that, and it was just getting suffocated. And, you know, again, same example, same recommendation, how to carve out these pockets. What are some species in the wetter areas you like to see beyond red osier dogwood? Some of the species in our areas, we try to find like milkweed, like swamp milkweed, Joe pieweed. I mean, some of those pollinator varieties that we like in there, that, again, not deer focused, but are there any other deer focused plants that you like to see maybe kind of in those wetter areas?
May apple grows down in there pretty good. There's some viburnums that grow in there pretty good. Cattails, I love introducing cattails. And then sometimes it's just not an option. So in that cedar swamp that I just referenced with the red osier dogwood and the pockets where the reed canary was growing, we're going to wipe out the reed canary. But in the meantime, we went in after a snowfall, see there's obvious buck beds, and we just enhance those buck beds with bales of straw. Instead of straw, I'll use wood chips, depending on if I can get equipment in there and haul it in. Straw usually, you know, in this case, walking on top of the ice was getting thinner. It was later in the year. I'll put the straw down and just make that buck bed more comfortable. And then occasionally in those areas where it's super wet, and you can see that when it's frozen, the bucks were laying there. I'm not talking about doe bedding. I'm talking about just buck bedding. You can take a piece of GeoGrid, the BX1100. You could do it with a piece of green plastic snow fence as well. Just take like a 4x8 section or 4x4 actually section, lay it down over that grass, and then put wood chips or put the straw, a bale of straw over, and just make like a nice little nest, butt it up to a tree that, you know, on the south side of a nice big tree, a cedar tree or something with maybe a log next to it. And now you've got the bucks bedding in there year round instead of only after pressure when they're pushed back in there when it freezes up.
Do you like those areas to have a little bit of a sun exposure, or do you want a little bit more cover in those areas so those, you know, around that edge doesn't grow up? What's your kind of tactic? Or you want a little bit of variety? I kind of like variety, but
absolutely variety. So, and then obviously if you're on the north side, you got to get some of the north. If you're on the north end of the property, you want the sun to be able to shine in, you know, with the wind being blocked. So as you move closer to the south, you can be more open because just the whole woods is blocking the north wind. You know what I mean? Just you have to see what side and what area of the property you're on.
And the cool thing about cedar swamps or cedar edges in those areas is usually a lot of times it stabilizes the air. The air is usually more consistent. And so that's a good thing. And that'll draw deer in at a consistent rate. So you need to think about that. The other piece I was going to mention was on my property, like I'm doing a bunch of different projects. Eastern gamma grass is what I've been using for a bunch of years. And so in some of these like wetter areas or wetter edges, not wet, but semi-wet, usually it's clay soil in my particular area, my lowland spots, I'm running eastern gamma grass all the way through the property. The deer consume it. So it's a digestible grass, which I think a lot of people aren't aware of. It's great cover, kind of like clump switchgrass, and then you can create pockets of it, and you can all obviously harvest it for cattle, et cetera. In my case, I'm using it for food and cover combination. But thinking about along these wetter edges, all the plant species you can put in place, and you know, start doing your research in your ecoregion, what's naturalized on the landscape. It's just a good way to go. But to Todd's point, getting out the reed canary grass out of the equation, I think, going to be helpful for you because it doesn't really have much wildlife value the way I see it. It could be excellent cover, especially during the summer months, but you know, at the end of the day, it's taking up space, and that's something we probably want to deal with.
And additionally, in those vast areas of reed canary, I mean, a round bale out there acts like a fake muskrat house. You take it out there in the winter, bucks will bed, they'll lay either on the southern side of it to block the wind and suck up the sun. They'll lay on top of it when it's tall, when the stuff is tall around it, they'll lay up on top of it, just like laying on a muskrat house. And then on those edges, side oats gamma is a good one. Purple coneflower. There's other ones that you can get that vegetation. May apple. I don't know if you have a lot of maple. It grows really good in moist areas. And it's a unique flower in that it's the only plant that the flower grows underneath the leaf, a little white flower under there that turns into an apple. And then the deer eat that apple later on.
Yeah.
One of my favorite though is touch me not in the wet areas. That's my favorite and the deer's favorite. Gets to a certain point when the flower is orange, that all of a sudden the deer just literally mow it right down. They love it so much. It's got like a balm in it. You can do it. It's almost like aloe vera, the inside of the seed or inside of the stem. And that's a really good one, and it grows really well. So if you find a pocket of it, you can transplant it. You can harvest seeds from it.
Todd, I got a question back for you. I just thought of a couple other plants, but I want to talk a little bit about cattails for a second. One of the plants that I did, I worked on a property recently, and I added across kind of the edge of the landscape was buttonbush. And I did find a significant amount of deer browse on that particular plant, which didn't surprise me. But some of these wet edible plants, like thinking about just deer interest and engagement, like finding these wet edible plants or even plants that may not normally grow or can handle a little bit of wet feet in those areas are going to be more browsed or more likely to be browsed in dry areas. So it's just trying to play with some plants in different areas. Like today, I was planting honey locusts in wet areas just to see how they would do. And so it's a test, right? They're not really designed for kind of wet feet, but let's see how they do. And then the other thing I was going to mention was one of the things we talked a little bit about is fencing off these little sections. I saw a video maybe recently, I think it was a Sturges video or somebody had sent it to me. I think it was Sturges video. He's creating these habitat pockets. Okay. And he's fencing in these particular areas. Now, kudos to him just, publicizing this bit of information, but finding some cheap fencing or areas that you can section off so you can not have the browse pressure to see what survives. Build up an area of red osier dogwood or silky dogwood or whatever species you want and use that as your resource to populate other areas. Unhook the cage, go to your next area. Unhook the cage, go to your next area. So it's just an easy kind of like process through your property. And then you kind of have a system of enhancement in sections. All right. So here's my question for you. Cattails. You keep bringing up cattails. Why do you like cattails so much?
Oh, they're great cover. I mean, deer love them. When there's pressure on, deer head for the cattails. They want their feet wet and they want the cover of the cattails. They're hidden in there. Nobody's coming anywhere near them. Not a coyote, not any predators getting anywhere near them without them hearing them a mile away. They go back in there and lay in little humps. It's just really good cover. And that's where the big bucks go automatically when there's any kind of pressure whatsoever. It's straight into there. So, and you can get a cattails. You can do a lot of good stuff with them. I like to get in there in the summer when if it's dry enough. And I just take my tractor bucket and I flip up a hump, depending on size, and I'll stick. Maybe it'll be a pine tree and a plum and an oak tree. Maybe it'll be, if it's really wet, I want some silver maples out there to drink and some red maple to start drinking water. We talked about in the past, a mature tree will drink 250 to 300 gallons of water a day that it releases in the atmosphere. So that's how you start to dry out your swamp by getting bigger trees like that to drink. Drink some of that water. A lot of times that's what happened. And in this area of Wisconsin, it's really bad because we had the emerald ash borer go through. So a lot of the ash trees, blue ash that were growing down in the swamps all died. So in multiples of 200 to 300 gallons of water that they would drink are gone. And then the reed canary smothers everything out. And I showed on my Instagram a number of times, and I think you and I talked about how after you, as a matter of fact, I'm getting ready to do one on a project probably as soon as the weather. I thought there was a day this week when I looked ahead to burn. If you burn it off, the canary, suddenly the sun can hit it. So you have evaporation. The wind can blow over. You have evaporation. It exponentially dries faster than keeping it wet as it was. And you'd be surprised what you can suddenly grow or what you can do with that area once it dries back out just by simply removing the canary grass.
So
sometimes willows come back naturally. Red osier dogwood comes back. The cattails, all kinds of stuff comes back.
You had mentioned I think big tooth cottonwood species that you
have. Yeah, cottonwood feels really good in there. Yeah.
Now, how do you introduce those? What's your technique to introduce those? Do you cut root cuttings? Like I got a way that I do it. So I want to listen to how do you approach it?
You can buy cottonless cottonwood relatively cheap, but I've got most of the areas around here, there are cottonwood trees all over. So you literally can make a muddy area and the cottonwood, you know, they're a messy tree. They'll drift all kinds of, it looks like it snowed out, and they'll grow in that muddy area. Just get down, you know, downwind of them, and you could grow all kinds of like that. And then from those little things, you can transplant those. You can snip off and root hormone and stick them in water, get them to root, plant them that way. Numerous ways to keep those going.
Yeah, sometimes with aspen, I think as another option in our particular area. So just, and at the same principle applies to cottonwood, is cutting portions of the roots and putting them in these wet areas or areas that have a little bit more moisture in them, they'll start taking off as long as you minimize competition around that particular plant. So that's one technique we've done. Aspen's really hard to regenerate in some of these stands. So again, different tree, but just thinking, some of the options that we have. Browse? Do you see browse in some of like cattails? I mean, do you cut them back? Do you ever see the deer eating the cattails or anything
mostly,
like that?
They'll mostly eat the muskrats are the only thing that eats cattails the most, or muskrats. The deer, I mean, occasionally you'll see like in late season, deer getting the tender roots of the reed canary grass and dig it down and eating those. And sometimes they'll eat, like if there's a cattail root right there, out of desperation, it seems like as they're browsing through, they eat some of it. I've seen it, but I mean, it's not, I think it's just an anomaly. And a lot of times it's the young deer just figuring out if it's something good or not there.
I do see, like in our particular areas, there's a lot of digging and they're eating different things. They're assessing the root quality and it, you know, what's the taste or the palatability of the roots, but that's a big piece of it. Now you started answering some of the questions for the next, you got ahead of us, but I didn't read the question yet. So let's go to question four. Thanks for all the information you put out. Appreciate that. We do put out a lot of information. So thanks for listening. I have really picked up a ton of useful information that I've been able to use on my ground here in, we'll just say Wisconsin. 10 of the 70 acres on the permission ground is continuous cattails. Any ideas how I can enhance the cattails to be more useful for deer? When it was really dry this summer, I went and cut large funnel trails to encourage them to move certain ways. I also took some of the cattails and piled them up, elevating to create deer beds in a few spots. Sounds like muskrat huts.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you've gone down this road already. Let's start talking about dealing with some of the wetter areas, assuming there's no permitting issues and you can just have at it. How would you approach some of this topic?
Well, I think that kid might've called me last year. It sounds familiar. So the areas that you cut, if they come back with reed canary, I'd spray them off. Let's see, you get some humps out there if you can, you know, if you get the tractor in there, just flip up some humps and start sticking in trees that are going to drink and start establishing edge is what you're looking for, right? If they get driven back into the middle of cattail swamps, or if there's some type of structure out in there is where they're going to go. But if it's just a monoculture of cattails, you have to create edge that they want to live on, whether they're, you know, the doe party's closer and the buck's back in farther. So go back in farther and maybe you can, when it's dry, take your tractor and a big log and dump it east-west orientation, or maybe a treetop by it, and then do the thing with the cattails to make a little nest for them. And then as you would come out to the edge close to the crop, maybe make some doe bedding areas, which would be bigger and hold more deer. I mean, those are just some of the ways, and you can mark those beds then. And if it's a gun situation, you're off to the edge so that you can look in there and see them get up out of their bed and see them going back to their beds, you know, play the wind, play that stuff right. But, and make sure it's really big, because it's a drag. If you get a bad hit, trying to drag one out of a vast cattail swamp at night is not fun.
Todd, it seems like one of the objectives is try to create dry land areas and wetland settings, basically, right. With structure. But when it comes right down to it, getting the deer to consistently use those, what are some of the tricks that a client or potential listener can do to get deer to use these particular areas? Creating pathways seems to be, creating deer flow through an area. Mm-hmm. How do you do that in areas? Because some of those areas that I've been in are, the water's up to your chest in some cases, or at least your belly.
Yeah.
And I know in the summer months, it's no big deal. And in the winter months, it can be a good big deal if things don't freeze. And sometimes they don't want to go through ice either. So maybe some concepts around that particular topic.
You'd be surprised. Deer walk right through those areas that we can't, like nothing. I've seen them do it when I've been back in there, and in swamps, they use their legs almost like marsh skis. So the part, like I would say the ankle portion of their foot, and then what you would refer to as their elbow, that's how they walk when they're on that pine. They walk like it's nothing. I'm like, how did this doe coming past me so fast in an area that I couldn't walk? My feet are bigger than a deer's foot. And then I saw like the whole herd came by, and that's how they were doing. Their leg was curled just like they have marsh skis, and they tool right along. So for developing the flow, actually use what they're already giving you. Any map that you look at, when you look on Onyx or any of the GPS maps, you're looking down, you can see the trails already there that they use. And it's pretty easy to distinguish, like, this is the buck trail, these are the doe trails, just by looking over. So start there. And then if you can get the GPS, the topo that will show you down to a foot, you can see the elevations there. And then those elevations are where you would start to find, obviously, beds, or if you want to do some enhancements on those little elevations. It doesn't take much to get it up out of the water. Those are the ways I do it. It's easier if you can burn it off, because then you can see all those little bumps instead of trying to find them on the GPS. It's really, really interesting to see after a burn, to look at it and see the low areas, see where the water flows through, see how much higher some of the areas are that you couldn't tell because it lay down, but the stuff stood up in the wet area. So it's deceiving. It looks like this is high and this is low. So a burn is always my first step if it can be done. But like this guy said, he's got permission on a portion of the property and owns another portion of the property. There's where I would do the treetops, a log, maybe some hay, straw rather. And that's the way you get them to use them. They already want to be in there. You just make them want to go where you want them to go.
Yep. Anything you do for trail enhancement, just to kind of add on to the points, do you add woodchips?
Yeah, I will. If there's trees that have tipped over that are blocking off the trail, that happens a lot, especially now with the dead ash. A lot of times those trees, I keep saying, I apologize to the listeners. The trees will tip over and then block off the trails or block off a complete area. So I'll go in and clean those up, maybe knock them down, turn them, things like that.
Okay. Now that's all good. I think that's super helpful for everybody. I thought these are a good set of questions, nothing out of sorts, some stuff we deal with pretty consistently and pretty consistent topics. Anything else you want to add? Any topics that are burning in your mind, things you're working on, anything you want to share with the audience? Anything new?
Not really too much. I'm just chomping at the bit to get out and do this stuff. I talked about this winter. It was frozen here, solid with limited snow cover. So I was able to get some box stands back into areas that we normally couldn't. And we used the forestry mulcher to make trails going to them so they would have good access. And then hunting in that type of situation, we took lattice and built a structure going along the base of the box blinds and then up the edge of the ladder going up to it. So through that lattice, you can get in and out of it without ever being silhouetted, no matter where the deer are bedded. And it's really working out nice.
Are you letting anything grow up through the lattice, or are you weaving stuff in? Okay.
Yep. Yep. The stuff can grow up through it. We'll put like grapevine, we'll stick different things if the sun's hidden enough. A lot of times it's not, and you end up with just the lattice, and you can drape some stuff off of it, but it really isn't necessary. If you use a good approach, play the wind, and you're fairly clean, it really doesn't matter anyhow. And a lot of those areas are going to be the two in one out approach where they'll get dropped off with a four wheeler and they can even get out, run a chainsaw and drive back out. And the deer within 15 minutes are going to be out there looking around and ready to, see what the guy just did with a chainsaw.
You said chainsaw running an ATV with a chainsaw. Okay. At the same time.
Yeah. Well, what I meant was you'll drive it with a chainsaw. One guy jumps off ATV with a chainsaw. A guy jumps off, goes in a blind. You may get out and just run the chainsaw a little bit. Turn the ATV off, run the chainsaw a little bit, weed eater, whatever it is. And the deer automatically, they're used to habitat improvement. They're used to doing that. Nobody's ever killed them with a chainsaw. You'd be surprised how a chainsaw is reassuring to deer that, somebody just cut a top and now they left. It's completely safe to go in there. And you'll find this interesting. Case in point, I mean, we do this all the time and it works so slick to drop a guy off and do that because the deer hear the chainsaw. They know nobody's ever shot them or nobody ever hunts right after you chainsawed an area. So the deer come in right away because they think there's a fresh tree trap laying there to eat or they'll see what happened. They're nosy. I'm telling this one of my clients and he's shaking his head the whole time I'm telling him, this is the end of year recap. He goes, Todd, I cannot believe you're saying this. He goes, now it makes sense. I go, what? He says, well, 5 years ago, I was cutting chainsaw, working out by my stand, and I ran out of time. I was in a hurry, kids, the whole young guy, busy kind of situation. He goes, suddenly I realized, oh my God, it's too late. I'm not going to hunt. And he wanted to hunt so bad. They said, I just set my chainsaw down, climbed up. I had my bow was there, climbed up on my tree stand with my, you know how you smell after your chainsaw. You smell like gas. You smell like exhaust. You smell all this stuff. Called the tree. He says, within 15 minutes, shot the biggest buck of his life. Came walking right in and he smoked it. And he goes, I thought it was a total anomaly or a suicidal deer or somebody scared it. I said, hell no, that deer lived its whole life. And a noise from a chainsaw never killed anything or caused any damage that he knows of other than when the chainsaw stops running, all the human activity is gone. So now that we've said this on a podcast, it'll probably change the deer. Like chainsaws will make them run because everybody out there with it. But it's a sweet trick, and it really works good in high pressure areas or in an area that you know the deer are, you know they're close, and it'd be a perfect area to hunt. But you don't have decent access; they can kind of see through the woods, maybe, or they've bedded up. It is a great way to get a hunter into an area, make a noise, make a diversion. He gets in a stand and you drive back out. It's a really slick way of getting a guy into an area.
I love it. I think that's a good way to end the podcast. I think people will really appreciate that trick. Todd, thanks for taking
kind of feedback.
Yeah. Thanks for taking time. It's been, my schedule's been bad, so I apologize, but you know how it is. I am that young, busy guy with a family and you know, it's just getting the ducks in a row all the time for me. That's a kind of a tough part. And like I said, I mean, you know, today, just a good example, like we had 3 hours, my son's got his buddy coming over. So we got to get these trees in. And, you know, I thought we were going to have a better day. You know, 38 degrees and rain is a little rough, you know, planting trees. So I think my daughter started shaking and I'm freezing, daddy. So that's, you know, the kids will appreciate the beauty.
Fire up your kiln and have her warm up by that.
I know. Next time I'm going to just have that big kiln going next to us. Baby. Just get by that kiln. So, yeah, no, that's an excellent point. I make some biochar.
Join the club. I swear to God, I've got the most beautiful weather, and the minute my tree order shows up, it gets cold and rains on me every single time. I plant more trees in the rain. But it's all right. On sunny, they have better success. On sunny days, you don't have to worry about cooking the roots. You don't have to worry about anything. It's just miserable, but they have great success.
Yeah, I agree. And things had dried out pretty quickly. So, you know, to get a little bit of that rain today, I think is a good thing. So, all right, man. Well, it was great catching back up with you. And thanks for sharing. And we'll talk again soon.
Thank you. Good luck, everybody out there. Have a good habitat season. We'll talk soon.
See you guys.
Take care. Bye.
Maximize Your Hunt is a production of Whitetail Landscapes. For more information on how John Teeter and his team of experts can help you maximize your hunt, check out whitetaillandscapes.com.
Raise the rudder! Raise the sails! Raise the sails!
Captain, an unidentified ship is approaching. Over.
Roger. Wait, is that an Enterprise sales solution?
Reach sales professionals, not professional sailors. With LinkedIn ads, you can target the right people by industry, job title, and more. Start converting your B2B audience today. Spend $250 on your first campaign and get a free $250 credit for the next one. Get started today at linkedin.com/campaign. Terms and conditions apply.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.